listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's a continuation of Original Sins by Adam Leith Gallner. A decisive turning point came 5 months after the wedding, when McInnes attended the 2006 American Renaissance Conference, a racial realist meetup that attracted hundreds of white nationalists. As its website explains, attendees are united by a common belief in black intellectual inferiority, opposition to non-white immigration, and ardor for maintaining America's white majority. While there, McInnes noted former KKK leader David Duke at the bar. "I texted my friends, just hanging out with my old pal David Duke," he explained in our interview. "That became like I'm at a Klan rally. I think some people used it as an excuse," meaning a reason to link McInnes to the KKK and, perhaps, get rid of him. Though he never actually wrote about the gathering, he characterized it as a reporting assignment. "It was just me doing my job," he claimed. Those around him weren't so sure. This was, after all, the same McInnes who'd written in 2002 that a liberal spotted at a strip club would either deny it was happening or claim it was some sort of research project. However one chooses to interpret McInnes's presence at the conference, it pretty much ended his relationship with Vice. "That became the moment," noted Pearson, "that forcing out of the company thing." The separation with McInnes took time, a period during which he and his wife had their first child. One day, McInnes recalled, corporate built a closed office for the top brass, and I was not in it. His desk instead was in the bullpen from which he worked, as well as working remotely, until he and the company parted ways. Leslie Arfin, a magazine contributor at that stage, who went on to be a writer on Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Girls, as well as co-creator of Love, believes that McInnes, to this day, may be stuck in trauma over what happened. "I don't think that he ever recovered from that humiliation," she insisted. "You lose your best friend and your job. That is like your entire effing personality. And you just had a baby, like, boom, three life-changing things right in the same stretch of time." "I was not fired," McInnes clarified. "We split because I wanted to keep it offensive and they wanted to get serious." Following McInnes's departure, the company completed its separation agreement with him in 2008. Vice started to experience phenomenal growth. By then, the company had pivoted toward online video, which would become one of the main sources of its success. In time, Vice Media, led by Smith and serving a lucrative millennial audience, would launch new digital video platforms and expand into film, music, and news, joining forces with partners such as MTV, HBO, Showtime, and Snap Inc., while attracting investors ranging from 21st Century Fox to Disney to George Soros. The office environment, however, was marred by allegations of sexual misconduct and bullying behavior, as well as outright sexism. 2 years ago, the company agreed to a $1.87 million payout to women employees who had been compensated less than their male counterparts. A heavily female leadership team is now in charge, with women currently accounting for more than half of Vice Media's global workforce. McInnes's deepening radicalism can be tracked online in a weekly column he wrote from 2008 to 2017 in Tacky's magazine, The at times far-right fomenting web scene published by the Greek journalist and socialite Taki Theodorakopoulos, co-founder of the American Conservative. Sample titles: The Myth of White Terrorism, Rioting the Unbeatable High, and What's the Matter with Blackface? McInnes was recruited to write there by Richard Spencer, who has since become one of the country's most reviled anti-Semites. People change and movements evolve, McInnes told me in one email. Richard Spencer said Hail Trump at that conference, and the whole thing went careening off a Nazi cliff. Spencer was a cool guy. He got me my job at Tachymag in 2008, after I left Vice. Back then, he was just some paleo-conservative who was obsessed with the Founding Fathers. The Spencer of today has nothing to do with the guy I knew 10 years ago. For his part, the McInnes of today describes his position as basic dad politics. He sent me a list outlining his views, saying they're the same views as any rational person. It included his thoughts on subjects such as racism is not a thing, America was not built on slavery, and gay marriage is a scam. His views were openly Islamophobic, transphobic, anti-feminist, and discriminatory toward a variety of groups. One through line, his underlying preoccupation with other people's bodies, identities, and their realities or personal decisions. When I asked him why he dwelled on that theme, he deflected, as usual. Proud Boys are unique Americans in the sense that they eschew identity politics. But as described by the SPLC, McInnes plays a duplicitous rhetorical game, claiming to reject white nationalism while espousing a laundered version of popular white nationalist tropes. McInnes is someone who apparently concluded long ago that white male privilege was imperiled. Come 9/11, believing that his reality was literally under attack, he'd embraced the notion that conservatism was essentially about upholding the status quo for those in power, meaning white men like himself. By 2016, in founding the Proud Boys, he tried to turn his ideologies into political action. Beyond that, McInnes's overarching philosophy seemed to be that free speech included hate speech. When you hate someone, as he once said, it's because you recognize something that you hate about yourself. I always thought he was a narcissist, Arfin mused. He's definitely profoundly narcissistic, Eric DeGrasse stated, while other members of his inner circle didn't hesitate in using stricter diagnostic labels. Regardless, DeGrasse still maintains ties with McInnes as an old friend in hopes of keeping him tethered to his humanity. In terms of my own repertorial interactions with McInnes, when I contacted him after a break of 2 decades in our communication, he offered to just jump ahead of all my questions and essentially interview himself so that I wouldn't need to interrupt with cardboard people words of my own. Among his concerns, that nothing he'd said be linked with Nazism. Everyone keeps coming back to, "Are you a Nazi?" he huffed. Nothing could be further from the truth, he insisted. I can only imagine it just seems like an unfortunate misunderstanding. It's not a misunderstanding, he retorted. It's a weapon that people use to try to silence someone else. Why, then, did he think that he's perceived to be the founder of a hate group? I am the most misunderstood person in America, he emphasized in a follow-up email, again deflecting and sounding not unlike one of his icons to whom he owes his recent notoriety, Trump. At no time in history has someone this reasonable been this misrepresented. He believed his predicament stemmed from the fact that in 2018, the SPLC classified the Proud Boys as a hate group, based on group members' violent conduct, their associations with white nationalist and neo-Nazi organizations, and statements disparaging women, minorities, and other marginalized groups. To date, he claimed he has spent $200,000 after raising it to sue the SPLC for defamation. The left set out to destroy my reputation, and they did a great job, he said. His latest opponent is the Canadian government, which has listed the Proud Boys as a terrorist neo-fascist entity. McInnes's association with the group could render him inadmissible if he attempts to return to the country. Although he served as its leader during its first 2 years, while the group became more formalized and militarized, he may have stepped down just in time. In Trump's America, the idea of the Proud Boys caught on and very quickly accelerated out of control, explained Jared Holt, resident fellow at the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Lab in Washington. It went from a gaggle of street brawlers into something able to earn the buy-in and the respect of massive portions of the GOP base. Holt, who has been monitoring the group since the start, told me it's really just a few steps removed from white genocide conspiracy theories. Throughout our conversation, McInnes came across as unwilling to take full responsibility for his situation. In his words, he'd simply wanted to F shit up. He didn't appear to recognize that statements he has made outlining his ideology are at the root of his troubles. McInnes's views have affected his home life. In 2018, ABC's Nightline interviewed him and his wife, Emily, at their house in New York's Westchester County, where residents put up signs vilifying him. On ABC, McInnes drank beer as his wife told him, "Your politics, having evolved this way in the last few years, has been a challenge." He looked away. Asked whether he was willing to apologize for what he'd created, he said no, firmly. Would he take any of it back, if possible? He thought about it, stroking his face roughly. "Yes, I guess, well, I don't know." Then he made a final, dismissive wave. "Nah," he said, as conclusively as he could muster. It was too late for all that. "It's a very chillax day," McInnes said, when I called him around midday on a Friday in March, trying to avoid the bar for as long as possible. "If you go there at noon, you're kind of effed for the day. At night, you're slurring." McInnes, an avid boozer, has consistently maintained that he started the Proud Boys as an outlet for harmless fun, an Animal House-style drinking club for male buddies. But even if he could see that what began as an extension of his brand had spiraled into something much more nefarious, he'd watched the Capitol riot on TV like everyone else. "I thought, what the F have you imbeciles done now?" he said. "They're not the brightest bulbs in the tree. They're not exactly sophisticated." At one point, he mentioned that he had warned his cohorts, "You're going to get shot. Someone's going to die. Do not go." Insisting a march on Washington was an obvious trap, just as he had cautioned marchers attending the deadly 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, which was organized by a then Proud Boy. Of all the pro-Trump outfits that broke into the houses of Congress, more Proud Boys have been arrested than those affiliated with other groups, such as the Oath Keepers or Three Percenters. Even so, McInnes contended that the group is being demonized. "The media wanted it to be a Proud Boys event so badly," he argued in March. "There were 30,000 people there that day, 250 arrested for storming the Capitol. Only a handful," he said, "happened to be members." More than 100 Proud Boys from across America traveled to Washington for the riot. To date, over 24 purported members have been charged. Prosecutors also allege that some of them coordinated their efforts with Oath Keepers. At the same time that FBI indictments of Proud Boys were being released publicly, a number of reports described McInnes's former company, Vice Media, as seeking to close a deal with a special-purpose acquisition company at around half its peak valuation of $5.7 billion 4 years ago. It wasn't clear, given Vice's outstanding debt and investors, where this would leave Smith, the company's biggest individual shareholder. Through the years, McInnes seemed to have adhered to the first half of his magazine's principles by living the stupid young part of his life smartly. Now well into his Gen X dotage, his current reality is another question. Either way, Vice alum Arfin noted, Vice will always be tied to this alt-right shit, and Gavin will always have this hipster liberal phantom cell phone vibration buzzing in the back pocket of his khakis. In our conversation, McInnes struck a genial tone. He said he hadn't changed much since the time I knew him. I hated the government. I still hate the government. I want it to burn to the ground. I want to burn it to the ground. I asked if he thought the government has him under surveillance. Oh, they absolutely do, he replied. This call's being listened to right now by the feds. The FBI and the NYPD monitor all my calls and follow all my texts. I'm banned from all social media. I've been depersoned. He had a theory on how he'd ended up this way. It went back to eighth grade. They put me in a special class, even though my grades were okay, because I was just a lot to handle, he confided. Eventually, if you keep being provocative, they'll try to separate you from the rest of the students, and that's what's happened on a much grander scale. I'm in the special class right now. That's the fate of someone who keeps being a class clown. I wondered whether he could see the difference between being a clown and inciting violence. Did he know that his actions led him here, that the words he'd uttered had consequences? I'm not going to deny any culpability here, he admitted. I've always wanted to kick the hornet's nest and keep things exciting, but the most recent developments are insane. I didn't know the hornets would be doing that. Some sources I interviewed wondered if McInnes, instead of playing the victim, might take this opportunity to repent or reverse course, no matter how cynically. He did neither. Others were curious if perhaps his parents and loved ones were in a position to help him, to help put him on a better path. But when I called his father, Jim McInnes, he was adamant that everything his son had done was a joke, that the media simply didn't get it. In fact, he said, he'd been writing a book about the whole thing. He even had a title. He was calling it Proud of My Boy. Now, from Caitlin Brody comes this Vanity Fair spotlight. The play's The Thing. Playwright Jocelyn Bio and director Sahim Ali reinvent the Merry Wives of Windsor for New York's beloved Shakespeare in the Park. Opening photograph by Dana Scruggs, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. In bloom, Sahim Ali and Jocelyn Bio photographed on April 27th on the Bridal Path in Central Park. As an undergrad studying acting, Jocelyn Bio was advised to steer clear of the bard. I was specifically told by my lead professor that I was a little too urban and my New York accent was a little too thick for Shakespeare. Now the actor-turned-playwright has adapted The Merry Wives of Windsor with an all-black cast for the public theater's Shakespeare in the Park. That's quite the debut for somebody who thought they'd never be a part of Shakespeare in any way, she says. The production will be directed by Bio's friend and collaborator Sahim Ali, who's the associate artistic director of The Public. Ali flirted with Shakespeare as a teen in Kenya, playing Mercutio in Romeo and Juliet, alongside classmate and future Oscar winner Lupita Nyong'o. At 22, he visited Manhattan for the first time and saw Twelfth Night in Central Park. I had never seen anything like it. The size, the scale, the acting, he says. That was the moment the dream was born to move to New York and direct at the Delacorte. Merry Wives, part of Ali and Bio's quest to celebrate black joy, is set in a West African neighborhood in Harlem and will run from July 6th through August 29th. When I was reading the script, I started to picture two black women sitting in a braiding salon, says Ali. Bio, who grew up in the city to Ghanaian parents, wasn't surprised. I probably spent 5 years cumulatively sitting in that salon. These are my people.
Thank you.
viral inflection. Throughout 2020, the theory that COVID-19 leaked from a lab was off limits. Those who dared to fight for transparency, say toxic politics and hidden agendas, kept us in the dark. By Catherine Aben, with opening illustration by Max Loeffler, showing the distinctive shape of the COVID-19 virus. One, a group called Drastic. Gilles de Meneuf is a data scientist with the Bank of New Zealand in Auckland. He was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome 10 years ago and sees it as an advantage. "I'm very good at finding patterns in data when other people see nothing," he says. Early last spring, as cities worldwide were shutting down, de Meneuf, 52, began reading up on the origins of SARS-CoV-2, the virus that causes COVID-19. The prevailing theory was that it had jumped from bats to some other species before making the leap to humans at a market in China, where some of the earliest cases appeared in late 2019. The Wanan Seafood Wholesale Market in the city of Wuhan was a complex of markets selling seafood, meat, fruit, and vegetables. A handful of vendors sold live wild animals, a possible source of the virus. That wasn't the only theory, though. Wuhan is also home to China's foremost coronavirus research laboratory, housing one of the world's largest collections of bat samples and bat virus strains. The Wuhan Institute of Virology's lead coronavirus researcher, Shi Zhengli, was among the first to identify horseshoe bats as the natural reservoir for SARS-CoV, the virus that sparked a deadly outbreak in 2002. After SARS, bats became a major subject of study for virologists around the world, and she became known in China as Batwoman for her fearless exploration of their caves to collect samples. More recently, she and her colleagues have performed high-profile experiments that made pathogens more infectious. Such research, known as gain of function, has generated heated controversy among virologists. To some people, it seemed natural to ask whether the virus causing the global pandemic had somehow leaked from one of the WIV's labs, a possibility she has strenuously denied. On February 19, 2020, The Lancet, among the most respected and influential medical journals in the world, published a statement that roundly rejected the lab leak hypothesis. Signed by 27 scientists, the statement expressed solidarity with all scientists and health professionals in China and asserted, "We stand together to strongly condemn conspiracy theories suggesting that COVID-19 does not have a natural origin." The Lancet statement effectively ended the debate over COVID-19's origins before it began. To de Meneuf, following from the sidelines, it was as if it had been nailed to the church doors, establishing the natural origin theory as orthodoxy. Everyone was intimidated. That set the tone. The statement struck de Meneuf as totally non-scientific. To him, it seemed to contain no evidence or information, and so he decided to begin his own inquiry in a proper way, with no idea of what he would find. De Meneuf began searching for patterns in the available data, and it wasn't long before he spotted one. China's laboratories were said to be airtight, with safety practices equivalent to those in the U.S. But de Meneuf soon discovered that there had been 4 SARS-related lab breaches since 2004, 2 at a top laboratory in Beijing. Due to overcrowding, a live SARS virus that had been improperly deactivated had been moved to a refrigerator in a corridor. A graduate student then examined it in the electron microscope room and sparked an outbreak. De Meneuf published his findings on Medium. By then, he had begun working with another armchair investigator, Rodolphe de Maistre. a laboratory project director based in Paris, who had previously worked in China, Demaistre was busy debunking the notion that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was a laboratory at all. In fact, the WIV housed numerous laboratories that worked on coronaviruses. Only one has the highest biosafety protocol, BSL-4, in which researchers must wear full-body pressurized suits with independent oxygen. Others are designated BSL-3 and even BSL-2, roughly as secure as an American dentist office. Having connected online, Demirneuf and Demaistre began assembling a comprehensive list of research laboratories in China. As they posted their findings on Twitter, they linked up with others around the world. Some were cutting-edge scientists at prestigious research institutes. Others were science enthusiasts. Together, they formed a group called DRASTIC, short for Decentralized Radical Autonomous Search Team Investigating COVID-19. Their stated objective was to solve the riddle of COVID-19's origin. At times, it seemed the only other people entertaining the lab leak theory were crackpots or political hacks. President Donald Trump's former political advisor, Steve Bannon, for instance, joined forces with an exiled Chinese billionaire named Guo Wangui to fuel claims that China had developed the disease as a bioweapon and purposefully unleashed it on the world. As proof, they paraded a Hong Kong scientist around right-wing media outlets until her manifest lack of expertise doomed the charade. With disreputable wing nuts on one side of them and scornful experts on the other, the DRASTIC researchers often felt as if they were on their own in the wilderness, working on the world's most urgent mystery. They weren't alone. But investigators inside the U.S. government asking similar questions were operating in an environment that was as politicized and hostile to open inquiry as any Twitter echo chamber. When Trump himself floated the lab leak hypothesis in April 2020, his divisiveness made things more, not less, challenging for those seeking the truth. "The DRASTIC people are doing better research than the U.S. government," says David Asher, a former senior investigator under contract to the State Department. The question is, why? 2. A can of worms. Since December 1, 2019, the SARS-CoV-2 virus that causes COVID-19 has infected more than 170 million people around the world and killed more than 3.5 million. To this day, we don't know how or why this novel coronavirus suddenly appeared in the human population. Answering that question is more than an academic pursuit. Without knowing where it came from, we can't be sure we're taking the right steps to prevent a recurrence. And yet, in the wake of the Lancet statement and under the cloud of Trump's toxic racism, which contributed to an alarming wave of anti-Asian violence in the U.S., one possible answer to this all-important question remained largely off-limits until the spring of 2021. Behind closed doors, however, national security and public health experts and officials across a range of departments in the executive branch were locked in high-stakes battles over what could and couldn't be investigated and made public. A months-long Vanity Fair investigation, interviews with more than 40 people, and a review of hundreds of pages of U.S. government documents, including internal memos, meeting minutes, and email correspondence, found that conflicts of interest, stemming in part from large government grants supporting controversial virology research, hampered the U.S. investigation into COVID-19's origin at every step. In one State Department meeting, officials seeking to demand transparency from the Chinese government say they were explicitly told by colleagues not to explore the WIV's gain-of-function research, because it would bring unwelcome attention to U.S. government funding of it. In an internal memo obtained by Vanity Fair, Thomas DiNanno, former acting assistant secretary of the State Department's Bureau of Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance, wrote that staff from two bureaus, his own and the Bureau of International Security and Nonproliferation, warned leaders within his bureau not to pursue an investigation into the origin of COVID-19, because it would open a can of worms if it continued. There are reasons to doubt the lab leak hypothesis. There is a long history of natural spillovers leading to outbreaks, even when the host animals have remained a mystery for months and years. And some expert virologists say the supposed oddities of the SARS-CoV-2 sequence have been found in nature. But for most of the past year, the lab leak scenario was treated not simply as unlikely or even inaccurate, but as morally out of bounds. In late March, former Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Director Robert Redfield received death threats from fellow scientists after telling CNN that he believed COVID-19 had originated in a lab. "I was threatened and ostracized because I proposed another hypothesis," Redfield told Vanity Fair. "I expected it from politicians. I didn't expect it from science." With Trump out of office, it should be possible to reject his xenophobic agenda and still ask why, in all the world, did the outbreak begin in the city with a laboratory housing one of the world's most extensive collections of bat viruses, doing some of the most aggressive research. Richard Abright, Ph.D., Board of Governors Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Rutgers University, said that from the very first reports of a novel bat-related coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan, it took him a nanosecond or a picosecond to consider a link to the WIV. "Only two other labs in the world, in Galveston, Texas, and Chapel Hill, North Carolina, were doing similar research. It's not a dozen cities," he said. "It's three places." Then came the revelation that the Lancet statement was not only signed but organized by a zoologist named Peter Daszak, who has repackaged U.S. government grants and allocated them to facilities conducting gain-of-function research, among them the WIV itself. David Asher, now a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute, ran the State Department's day-to-day COVID-19 origins inquiry. He said it soon became clear that there is a huge gain-of-function bureaucracy inside the federal government. As months go by without a host animal that proves the natural theory, the questions from credible doubters have gained in urgency. To one former federal health official, the situation boiled down to this: an institute funded by American dollars is trying to teach a bat virus to infect human cells. Then there is a virus in the same city as that lab. It is not being intellectually honest not to consider the hypothesis of a lab escape. And given how aggressively China blocked a transparent investigation and its government's history of lying, obfuscating, and crushing dissent, it's fair to ask if Xi Zhengli, the Wuhan Institute's lead coronavirus researcher, would be at liberty to report a leak from her lab, even if she wanted to. On May 26th, President Joe Biden announced that the intelligence community had coalesced around two likely scenarios and asked for a more definitive conclusion within 90 days. His statement noted, "The failure to get our inspectors on the ground in those early months will always hamper any investigation into the origin of COVID-19. That wasn't the only failure. In the words of David Feith, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the East Asia Bureau, the story of why parts of the U.S. government were not as curious as many of us think they should have been is a hugely important one. 3. Smelled like a cover-up. On December 9, 2020, roughly a dozen State Department employees from four different bureaus gathered in a conference room in Foggy Bottom to discuss an upcoming fact-finding mission to Wuhan, organized in part by the World Health Organization. The group agreed on the need to press China to allow a thorough, credible, and transparent investigation. The conversation then turned to the more sensitive question, what should the U.S. government say publicly about the Wuhan Institute of Virology? A small group within the State Department's Arms Control, Verification, and Compliance Bureau had been studying the Institute for months. The group had recently acquired classified intelligence, suggesting that three WIV researchers conducting gain-of-function experiments on coronavirus samples had fallen ill in the fall of 2019, before the COVID-19 outbreak was known to have started. As officials at the meeting discussed what they could share with the public, they were advised by Christopher Park, the director of the State Department's Biological Policy Staff in the Bureau of International Security and Nonproliferation, not to say anything that would point to the U.S. government's own role in gain-of-function research, according to documentation of the meeting obtained by Vanity Fair. Some of the attendees were absolutely floored, said an official familiar with the proceedings, that someone in the U.S. government could make an argument that is so nakedly against transparency in light of the unfolding catastrophe was shocking and disturbing. Park, who in 2017 had been involved in lifting a U.S. government moratorium on funding for gain-of-function research, was not the only official to warn the State Department investigators against digging in sensitive places. As the group probed the lab leak scenario, among other possibilities, its members were repeatedly advised not to open a Pandora's box, said four former State Department officials. The admonitions smelled like a cover-up, said DiNanno, and I wasn't going to be part of it. Reached for comment, Park denied suggesting that information be withheld from policymakers or the public. I'm skeptical that people genuinely felt they were being discouraged from presenting facts, he said, adding that it is making an enormous and unjustifiable leap to suggest that research of that kind meant that something untoward is going on. 4. An antibody response. There were two main teams inside the U.S. government working to uncover the origins of COVID-19, one in the State Department and another under the direction of the National Security Council. No one at the State Department had much interest in Wuhan's laboratories at first, but they were gravely concerned with China's apparent cover-up of the outbreak's severity. The government had shut down the Huanan market, ordered laboratory samples destroyed, claimed the right to review any scientific research about COVID-19 ahead of publication, and expelled a team of Wall Street Journal reporters. In January 2020, a Wuhan ophthalmologist named Li Wenling, who tried to warn his colleagues that the pneumonia could be a form of SARS, was summoned by police, accused of disrupting the social order, and forced to write a self-criticism. He died of COVID-19 the next month, lionized by the Chinese public as a hero and whistleblower. As questions swirled about the Chinese government's coercion and suppression, Miles Yu, the State Department's principal China strategist, noted that the WIV had remained largely silent. Yu, who is fluent in Mandarin, began mirroring its website and compiling a dossier of questions about its research. In April, he gave his dossier to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who in turn publicly demanded access to the laboratories there. It is not clear whether Yu's dossier made its way to Trump, but on April 30, 2020, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence put out a statement whose apparent goal was to suppress a growing furor around the lab leak theory. It said that the intelligence community concurs with the wide scientific consensus that the COVID-19 virus was not man-made or genetically modified, but would continue to assess whether the outbreak began through contact with infected animals, or if it was the result of an accident at a laboratory in Wuhan. It was pure panic, said former Deputy National Security Advisor Matthew Pottinger. They were getting flooded with queries. Someone made the unfortunate decision to say, "We basically know nothing, so let's put out the statement." Then the bomb thrower in chief weighed in. At a press briefing just hours later, Trump contradicted his own intelligence officials and claimed that he had seen classified information indicating that the virus had come from the Wuhan Institute of Virology. "Ask what the evidence was," he said. "I can't tell you that. I'm not allowed to tell you that." Trump's premature statement poisoned the waters for anyone seeking an honest answer to the question of where COVID-19 came from. According to Pottinger, there was an antibody response within the government in which any discussion of a possible lab origin was linked to destructive nativist posturing. The revulsion extended to the international science community, whose maddening silence frustrated you. He recalls anyone who dares speak out would be ostracized. 5. Too risky to pursue. The idea of a lab leak first came to NSC officials not from hawkish Trumpists, but from Chinese social media users who began sharing their suspicions as early as January 2020. Then, in February, a research paper co-authored by two Chinese scientists based at separate Wuhan universities appeared online as a preprint. It tackled a fundamental question: how did a novel bat coronavirus get to a major metropolis of 11 million people in central China in the dead of winter when most bats were hibernating, and turn a market where bats weren't sold into the epicenter of an outbreak? The paper offered an answer. "We screened the area around the seafood market and identified two laboratories conducting research on bat coronavirus. The first was the Wuhan Center for Disease Control and Prevention, which sat just 280 meters from the Huanan market and had been known to collect hundreds of bat samples. The second was the Wuhan Institute of Virology." The paper came to a staggeringly blunt conclusion about COVID-19. The killer coronavirus probably originated from a laboratory in Wuhan. Almost as soon as the paper appeared on the internet, it disappeared, but not before U.S. government officials took note. By then, Pottinger had approved a COVID-19 origins team run by the NSC directorate that oversaw issues related to weapons of mass destruction. A longtime Asia expert and former journalist, Pottinger purposefully kept the team small because there were so many people within the government wholly discounting the possibility of a lab leak. He said, "In addition, many leading experts had either received or approved funding for gain-of-function research. Their conflicted status," said Pottinger, "had the effect of contaminating the shot at having an impartial inquiry." As they combed open sources as well as classified information, the team soon stumbled on a 2015 research paper by Xi Jingli and the University of North Carolina epidemiologist Ralph Barrick, proving that the spike protein of a novel coronavirus could infect human cells. Using mice as subjects, they inserted the protein from a Chinese rufous horseshoe bat virus into the molecular structure of the SARS virus from 2002, creating a new infectious pathogen. The gain-of-function experiment was so fraught that the authors flagged the danger themselves, writing, "Scientific review panels may deem similar studies too risky to pursue." In fact, the study was intended to raise an alarm and warn the world of a potential risk of SARS-CoV reemergence from viruses currently circulating in bat populations. The paper's acknowledgments cited funding from the U.S. National Institutes of Health and from a nonprofit called EcoHealth Alliance, which had parceled out grant money from the U.S. Agency for International Development. EcoHealth Alliance is run by Peter Daszak, the zoologist who helped organize the Lancet statement. that a genetically engineered virus might have escaped from the WIV was one alarming scenario, but it could also be possible for a natural virus collected in the field to leak from a lab. The NSC investigators found ready evidence that China's labs were not as safe as advertised. She herself had publicly acknowledged that until the pandemic, all of her team's coronavirus research, some involving live SARS-like viruses, had been conducted in less secure BSL-3 and even BSL-2 laboratories. In 2018, a delegation of American diplomats reported that a shortage of highly trained technicians and clear protocols at the WIV's new BSL-4 lab threatened its safe operations. The issues had not stopped the WIV's leadership from declaring the lab ready for research on Class 4 pathogens, P4, among which are the most virulent viruses that pose a high risk of aerosolized person-to-person transmission. On February 14, 2020, to the surprise of NSC officials, President Xi Jinping of China announced a plan to fast-track a new biosecurity law to tighten safety procedures throughout the country's laboratories. Was this a response to confidential information? In the early weeks of the pandemic, it didn't seem crazy to wonder if this thing came out of a lab, Pottinger reflected. Apparently, it didn't seem crazy to Xi either. A Scientific American article, first published in March 2020, for which she was interviewed, described how her lab had been the first to sequence the virus in those terrible first weeks. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.